Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, thanks for joining me. I'm excited to bring you this conversation with a real master of his craft, award-winning casting director John Papsidera. The multi-talented Papsidera is a trained actor, an art gallerist, and has a decades-long career as one of Hollywood's foremost casting directors. His films include Jurassic World, Suicide Squad, TV series such as Westworld, The Offer, Wednesday, and Yellowstone, and of course, a long collaboration with director Christopher Nolan. Papsidera has cast most of his films, from Memento, The Dark Knight Trilogy, Interstellar, Inception, Dunkirk, and of course, his latest, Oppenheimer. In our conversation, we talk about what went into assembling that incredible cast for Oppenheimer that just this week passed a whopping $700 million at the global box office. We talk about his collaboration with Nolan, what it entails to cast a biopic, pivotal readings he's had with actors, casting the likes of Charlize Theron, Heath Ledger as the Joker, his thoughts on AI and the strikes, and so much more. John Papsidera, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Prior to Oppenheimer, I had a few images of the real Robert J. Oppenheimer in my consciousness, you know, as you do with a historical figure.
Sure.
One was the very intense close-up of that CBS interview he did sometime in 1965 when he said, "Now I become death at Bhagavad Gita," quotes in black and white. And the other was the cover of American Prometheus. Both of them very focused on his eyes, close up, the stare. There was a lot of ambiguity and guilt sort of in what you could see. And then when I saw the casting announcement, I remember thinking, wow, Killian, that's perfect. Yeah. How did you arrive at him?
Well, I mean, look, we've had a relationship, and I refer to Chris as Christopher Nolan. We've had a relationship with Killian for a lot of years, always been huge fans and knew how talented and special he was. And when I first met with Chris about Oppenheimer, I sat down and he said, do you want to talk about ideas for Oppenheimer? And I brought up some of the usual suspects. And he said, I've been staring at that picture on American Prometheus. And he said, I think it's Killian. And I said, well, I mean, Killian would be phenomenal. You know, he's not as tall as Oppenheimer was, but regardless, you know, Tom Hardy was not as tall as what's-his-face was supposed to be in Dark Knight Rises, Bane. But I said, you know, Killian is absolutely amazing. And I think we both felt too, Killian had, been in so many of the films that it was, you know, it was high time that he took center stage in one, and it just seemed like a perfect opportunity. So, Chris initially brought it up, when we started talking about ideas, and I couldn't have been more pleased.
At one point you were thinking of him as Batman.
Yeah, he tested for Batman. Of the five actors, Killian tested, he was one of them. And we loved his read and loved his work, but it just didn't feel like it was the right fit for Batman.
He did get the right fit, though, in your movie.
He did. He got the scarecrow. Right. We kept a bag over his head and gave him the scarecrow.
But going back to Oppenheimer, when casting for a biopic and looking for actors with real counterparts, tell me a little bit about how that process is unique and different.
Well, I think it's different for every project, you know, depending on the producers, depending on the studio, depending on the director. And you know, I had done The Offer for Paramount,
which is The Godfather,
right? The remake,
Making of the Godfather,
Making of the Godfather. And you know, their perspective was different than necessarily Oppenheimer's. You know, both looking for real people. But in Oppenheimer, I think the biggest thing was Chris and I talked about the idea of, for these roles, he really wanted people to bring a gravitas for these roles. I mean, there was a dual purpose in why we cast so many celebrity or stars, you know, actors, name actors. And part of it, and the very first idea was, we need to represent these people and give them respect that they deserved and garnered in that actual period. They were the rock stars of the, you know, of the scientific world, Oppenheimer being certainly the biggest of them. But all of them, we felt like, out of respect, we need to cast actors that are of the same kind of visibility and weight as these people had in their time. So that was first and foremost. And then, you know, secondly, Chris also was quite aware, as we all were, that we're doing a 3-hour movie about a scientist and we're competing with Marvel movies. You know, I mean, that's right. You know, the reality. So we did want to stack the deck in a way as well, just to try and garner as many eyeballs and compete with what the market looks like, you know, these days in feature films and theatrical releases.
And for people who listening who don't know, for someone like Matt Damon, does he read, or do you just call him and offer it? No, there's nothing of that.
No, we had worked with Matt in Interstellar. So, and, you know, and he had expressed an interest in working with Chris again. So it was, you know, we reached out to Matt and, no, those Matt and Robert and Rami and a lot of those, Ken Branagh was a phone call, but most of them, Robert Downey Jr., they just met with Chris. Mm-hmm. That's usually the process for the most part in large roles. We'll talk about it and talk through ideas that we like. And once we center on one and Chris decides if he'd like to meet them, then they usually either in some combination, either read the script first and then sit and talk to him about it afterwards, or vice versa. He will talk to them and pitch them the ideas that he's thinking about, and then they'll read a script. So one or the other, and that's usually done, you know, in private at his compound or some version thereof. And then we try and make deals with them.
How important is actual physical likeness?
It is. I mean, but case in point, The Offer was incredibly important because those were such visible people, you know. Mm-hmm. You're trying to cast Ally McGraw, you want somebody that kind of looks like Ally McGraw, or, you know, Bob Evans or whatever. But beyond that, Oppenheimer, we weren't saddled with the idea that all these people were incredibly well known. But again, kind of out of respect to them, we tried to stay as true as we could with looks and essences of people. Obviously, intelligence was really important for these people to convey a sense of intelligence. Also, nationalities and accents were really important to us. So, you know, if they were Hungarian, we were looking for Hungarian actors or people that brought authentic sounds to the script and into the world of that scientific community, which was incredibly varied. You know, all the way from Fermi being Italian to, you know, Oppenheimer being American. Like, there was a quite an eclectic mix of scientists that we tried to be as faithful as we could to.
One of the things I've read that you've said a few times, and I can really see in your work, is that you're looking for the soul of a person more than anything else. And I thought of that later when I was thinking about talking to Safdie as Edward Teller. Well, I thought that was the absolute perfect casting, because he has both a very interesting appearance, but he has this ambiguity to him, which you feel in this person. Teller was completely new to me.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about finding someone like that.
Well, Chris is a fan of the Safdie brothers, and And he did mention to me, I don't know, I thought about Benny Softy. I don't know, what do you think of that? And I said, look, he's fantastic. And I think the reality was that, again, he kind of looked like Teller. You know, and in fact, I heard something afterwards, after we cast Benny, was that Chris had had a conversation with him eventually and said, let your eyebrows grow. I want them to go crazy, because Teller had crazy kind of eyebrows. So, and it's such an iconic look. I mean, it's one of my favorite shots in the film when he's
the glasses
there with the,
and the
sunscreen on his face, which was all true. You know, they put zinc oxide on their face and sat there and watched it. And I love the fact that, you know, also it's a little bit left of center, it was an unexpected move in casting to use him as Teller, not, you know, a normal suspect, that, you know, the usual suspects that you would consider.
And another one I thought was amazing was the casting of Josh Hartnett as Ernst Lawrence, right?
Yeah, as Lawrence. Yeah, he was great. I mean, you know, it's funny because historically we don't go back to people that don't say yes the first time in casting. And Josh was one of those that didn't say yes. Chris had met with him regarding Batman, and he didn't see it for himself. And usually that's the death knell. But in this case, you know, Lawrence was kind of a American movie star of that world. And Josh aligned with that so perfectly, both physically and just his Americana kind of feel and vibe and essence, that we circled back and made an exception to that rule and wanted to see a bit. Oh, Josh has also been quoted in articles saying that he regretted passing on Batman, or that he had regrets about it. So we circled back and I have to say, Josh jumped through a lot of hoops to make that work. And so I'm indebted and grateful that he did.
It took me a while to see that it was
him. It's so funny. A lot of people have said that about characters in the movie, that they didn't recognize them at first, which I think is an absolute credit to the actor. You know, I mean, to be able to, like Gary Oldman as Truman, that's one of my favorite pieces. So many people didn't realize that was Gary that I've spoken to. And everything from the accent to the lips to all of it was just kind of brilliant. It was another turn that I really loved.
Well, with someone like Gary Oldman and the cast that you have, I mean, you're gonna get that.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and Robert, the same. My wife had said to me that she didn't even recognize that it was Robert initially, until, you know, moments into it, and then went, oh my god, that's Robert Downey Jr. So, you know, I think a lot of people kind of did that. And I commend them and Chris for capturing that, you know.
In general, when you get a script from Chris or from someone else, you read it, do names and people start popping into your head? What's your process when you're reading?
I try not to, you know, a lot of people, and once in a while it will happen, you know, somebody kind of undeniable is in your head and you start reading it that way. But I really... you know, a lot of people have said, ask me that, and or do you have a favorite actor? And, you know, my response is I have to have 350 favorite actors, you know, in that my job is to provide options, not to be locked into one choice. So while some things are undeniable or you feel that initially, there's a myriad of reasons why it might not work out that way. So I try and read a script without any real visuals in my head. And then we'll circle back before I meet with the director or producers to then try and explore what the possibilities of that character are. And so much of it goes into, you have to have the understandings of what your budget limitations are, what the studio is going to require for names, not names, to publicize the project. So a lot of those kind of background issues come into when you're starting to think creatively about roles. And you have to tick all those boxes in your head. I mean, anybody just write down, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and Meryl Streep for every role. But, you know, they don't fit that always. And two, it's not always realistic. So I like to have as many options as I can in order to not only creatively fulfill what a director is looking for, but all the other people that, you know, are relying on a cast to fulfill their dreams and needs as well.
Did you have any options that you're at liberty to say for Oppenheimer that didn't turn out?
I mean, there's one that really, you know, kind of sticks in my mind, which I don't know if I'll say or not, but I, you know, I tend to say things that I shouldn't. yeah, we had had discussions with John C. Reilly for a role, and he was supposed to meet with Chris, and ultimately that didn't happen through a lot of different reasons. He didn't really want to read the script, and it was too long, and it was, you know, a big time commitment, and a lot of things came up there. But so, you know, there are those things in every project that, you know, you hit a bump in the road or a speed bump. It always feels bigger with Chris. In so far as, you know, I like to say to him, okay, well, after I read a script, who do you want? Because it's good to be king, you know, and, you know, more often than not, we are, blessed with a large variety of people putting their hands up.
I'm talking a little bit about the process where you're actually reading with actors. You are a trained actor yourself. So I suppose this must be good for you in that, in terms of getting someone, an actor, to feel very relaxed and you know what they're going through. What are you looking for? Do you want them to be in character? What kind of preparation?
I think, it depends on really what you're doing. You know, if you're doing a comedy, you want people to find the joke. You know, you want people to be inventive. I think if there's one common denominator for me, you know, choices an actor makes separates the wheat from the chaff every time. Plenty of people come in and you know, the majority of actors will come in and read the scene. And that's what you get, you know. But the really special actors will come in and make choices that surprise you, that you didn't think of when you saw it, that makes a different interpretation of a line. Whatever that is, it comes down to choices. I've used this example before, but I did a film, and God love her soul, Anne Heche came in to read after every girl in Hollywood. A lot of girls in Hollywood had read for this project that I did years ago. And the scene was a secretary taking notes and dictation from John Goodman's character in a movie called Kingfish. Mm-hmm. And everybody came in with some version either of a steno pad and a pencil where they're taking notes, or they come in with, you know, pretending like they're typing on a you know, typewriter. And Anne Heche made the choice to come in and just sit and listen to him. And when he got done with the dictation, got up and walked out. And then she came back in the scene with the typewritten letter. And that, I still get chills, that her choice was, she was smart enough to remember the entire letter and get it letter perfect. And that assumption of the intelligence of that character was like, oh my God, that's the brilliance of it. So you look for people that make great choices. And I say to actors, it doesn't have to be as dramatic as that, but it should be something that you're imbuing your own special imprint on, your interpretation of it, you know, because look, in film, 90% of the time, people are playing some version of themselves, right? We're hiring them to look like they do, sound like they do, walk like they do. That is, you know, the large part of it. The other 10% is creativity and genius and inspiration and magic and all those other things. So you're looking for people to find those moments, at least I do, that then separate them out from everybody else.
There's a wonderful example there with Anne Heche. Is there someone else through all your decades of work that's read for you that we didn't know of, but that just blew your mind so much?
I mean, Charlize was that, you know. Wow. I helped put Charlize in her first movie, 2 Days in the Valley. And, you know, it's the other thing where, you know, casting directors and or directors mostly like to claim that they discovered someone, you know, and I stay away from that language because the reality is that it is a creative process. And I never would have read Charlize had a manager by the name of John Crosby called me and said, hey, I know you're looking for a tall Nordic girl. I just met this girl in the bank in the line waiting for a teller. She's tall and beautiful and South African. Would you read her? And I said, yeah, absolutely. So it's about being open to those creative ideas, trusting what people suggest to you. And that all comes from agents and managers most of the time that you work hand in hand with. And over the years, you begin to trust people where they, you know, have not led you astray in the past. And those were one of those moments. So, yeah, I mean, you go back and look through almost every movie. It happens. If you have the trust and the director and producers and the studio have the faith that magic happens, it always shows up in one way or another. And so I try and believe in fate and faith, have faith in that as much as possible.
Kelly Riley was certainly not new, but the fact that you cast her in the role that she has in Yellowstone is pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when Taylor first brought that up to me and we were talking about prototypes, he didn't know Kelly. But I, you know, you wanted somebody that could be smart and ballsy and irreverent. And Kelly always struck me as that. I mean, you know, she was an actress that would take chances. And, you know, there was a handful of girls that we sent the script to. And, you know, Kelly was really one of the first ones that raised her hand and said, let me talk to Taylor, that she just got it and moved quick enough that the other girls were, you know, kind of left out to dry. But yeah, you know, again, those things happen and you just go, I'm glad I had that idea, but I'm also glad that it worked and she's magnificent in that role.
You do a lot of projects with so many people, big casts, and I'm thinking like a fictional families like that. I mean, are you looking for likeness there?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think, you know, again, it comes down to what you need and what the producers expect and what the studio expects on some level. So, I usually try to veer away from all-star casting, you know, where every face is somebody you know, kind of, you know, instance, which, you know, Chris and I talked about, and Emma as well, Chris's producer and wife, talked about that you didn't want to get pulled out of the movie, you know, and there's plenty of examples where you just go, what? Why is
you're
that
just thinking
there?
You can just see that actor all the time when you're watching it.
Yeah. And it bothers for me, really pulls me out of the moment of watching a film. And I think for a lot of people, it does. You're thinking of them as an actor, not as the character. And so I thought we walked that tightrope, I hope, really well in Oppenheimer, because I didn't have any of those moments of getting pulled out. And I think we did stack the deck as best we could.
As I said, it took me a while to even realize that it was this huge actor in several films.
Yeah.
And another thing that you're exceptional at that, you know, that we laymen aren't, that is sort of casting against type, that after we've seen that actor in that role, we're like, well, there could have been no other one. To get to that, how often do you like cast against type and think, yeah, this will work? It seems it wouldn't, but it does.
Yeah. I mean, you try to, and I think, you know, you try and think, I try and get inside of an actor's mind and figure out why they would want to do a role. And, you know, and other than working with a director, or it being a great role, what else do they have to show? So you look for other sides of actors. I mean, you know, human beings are incredibly complex and multifaceted. And usually you get that through an actor's work, looking at their work over time. Or for me, I really get that when I sit and talk to someone, and why I value interviews and just meeting actors so much, is that you get, I'll bring up, you know, what kind of family did you have? What was your relationship with your brother, your sister, your mother, your father? You get all these different aspects to a person that you don't get just watching their work. Mm-hmm. And any of those clues could lead you to believe and or make up that they have a bit of a character within them, you know? And so that's what I kind of look for. And that's what I kind of enjoy doing is, you know, mining actors for the possibilities, and then your imagination takes over, and you know, hopefully theirs does, and it aligns, you know. But that's kind of what you're looking for.
I want to ask you about Heath Ledger. Amazing. Yeah. What was the process? That didn't seem like something that was absolutely certain.
No,
that he would be the Joker.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
We pursued three people for the Joker. One was Leonardo. Mm-hmm. We never heard back. Number two was Joaquin Phoenix. Joaquin sat with Chris and explained to him why he didn't want to play the Joker, and that he didn't like big action or big Hollywood movies. And then he wanted a more independent career, which I find fascinating that he ultimately turns around and plays the Joker and wins an Oscar. That's just one of those antidotes that you go, that's wild. And the third was Heath. And, you know, both Chris and I responded to the fact that Heath saw it like Chris did, that, you know, he was much more attuned to Malcolm McDowell
in Kubrick?
Yeah. Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange.
But he was in mm-hmm. Clockwork Orange than he was Jack Nicholson in, you know, the Batman films. I think a lot of people worried about stepping into Nicholson's shoes doing that role. But, you know, really that character, and as Chris conceived it, he was an anarchist. He just wanted anarchy. He just wanted to tear it all down. And Heath clued into that. And he and Chris talked about that, and film history pursued, ended up. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant in that role.
The reactions just for the casting announcement were very different from after everyone actually had seen it, which is
right. And Heath hadn't shown that side of himself, you know, and it was a phenomenally exciting prospect when we did it. And then afterwards, it's like, oh yeah, we looked like geniuses, but really it was Heath's genius that pulled that off.
You've worked with James Gunn as well.
Yes.
How would you say his process in these type of movies is to Nolan's?
Incredibly different. Incredibly mm-hmm. different. You know, when I read Chris's scripts, and I'm gratefully one of the first people that read a new script that he does, I'll go to his house and I'll sit alone in a room and read it and then sit with him and talk afterwards. But what you realize is that 99.9% of what's on the page is what will be in the film. Chris has already had the entire film planned out in his head. And so it's much more like puzzle making and doing with Chris, in that I just need an actor to play the role as Chris sees it. It's like a fine Swiss watch. Mm-hmm. And I need that little part to do what he wants him to do. It's not about an exploration necessarily of what else can you bring. And, you know, those conversations happen with him for lead roles, but everybody else really needs to fit their part in telling the story. And James is much more emotional about things. It's, you know, he will have concepts and he will have ideas in his head, but it's much more an emotional journey of What James likes, what he responds to. Humor is a huge part of what he looks for in actors, and somebody that can pull that off. Whereas, you know, I mean, I think the only bit of humor in Oppenheimer really is Matt Damon, which is part of the reason why we wanted Matt to play that role. There's a dry sense of humor that, you know, casually Matt can do incredibly well. And so it doesn't come, you know, there's not a lot of laughs in Interstellar or, you know, Inception. It's much more of a different kind of vein that you're looking for in actors to bring believability. Whereas James, you need humor and believability and intelligence. It's just a different mix. And what he responds to is incredibly spontaneous at times, rather than you know, intellectually, you know, thought about.
I wanted to ask you a bit about things that we're talking a lot about in the strikes, for example, AI. Mm. How do you feel about that in terms of your art?
I'm not thrilled with it. You know, I don't, it concerns me. You know, I think what we do is deal, and you were kind enough to say in the beginning about me matching souls to roles that are two-dimensional. So much of it is about the human experience. So much of it is about finding the idiosyncratic behavior human beings that shed light on the rest of our lives, you know, as a viewer, windows into somebody's soul. And when you start to talk about AI, well, that's not a window into anyone's soul. It's a window into electronics and to, you know, something scientific and mechanical, not emotions and human beings. And so I think, you know, any point for me, the point of art is to move us as human beings, right? It's what we express our way, our things through movie theaters in some ways. I make up are like, you know, telling stories at campfires for Neanderthals around a fire, or the Native American culture. It replaces that lineage of storytelling by being in a dark room and imagining yourself in another world or in somebody else's shoes. And when it turns into a video game or electronics, I think you lose so much of that, you know. An amalgamation of people brought together into a, you know, a visual is not the person. It's an amalgamation trick, if you will. So I have a lot of concerns about it. But that being said, we also don't know what the technology is even going to provide, which is why I wish they would put it to the side in these negotiations and get people back to work. I don't think we know what AI is going to be capable of doing and or do. So maybe we should just put it to the side and wait until we have a better idea of what it's actually going to be. If it's just Max Headroom, an old reference, you know, maybe it's not the same thing that we're all imagining this could be. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an incredibly complex conversation and decision, way over my head. But I don't quite know if we know what we're unleashing.
You think they should have some provisions or something and then just put it to the side?
Yeah, I would think so. Like, you know, address it when you can address it. I just don't know that anybody, and you know, maybe Elon Musk could, maybe, you know, Google could talk about, well, what it might do. But we don't know what it might do yet, you know?
Well, I guess so, what I've heard is the sort of the body scanning of the extras, yeah, and things like extras, that, yeah, that you have in perpetuity, you could use, right, their likeness.
And I think that's a valid thing. Like, you know, maybe you just do that for, you know, you only allow it for one individual project, and mm-hmm, it's not in perpetuity, and it's not in any, you know, movie that anybody wants to use it in. I think there's other ways to go about doing that and making a rule about that. And protections for people, right, as opposed to, you know, and, you know, even that, it's like, not very many, I know Chris wouldn't sign up for it. Not many directors are going to want to use AI to fill in their backs, their, you know, stand-in players or their background players. Those scenes are incredibly different. And I think as a filmmaker, every frame is a picture, right? Every frame is a piece of your art. I don't know that I want to see the same replicated people in every frame of my film. It seems very odd. And I think it would be an infringement.
Roman gladiators.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like an infringement on the creative process. And most directors would probably opt out of that, I would think.
What about the discussion about like Jewish actors playing Jewish roles and things like that, that we're also hearing a lot about now?
Yeah, I am bringing that up because of Superman. No,
today it was Maestro.
Oh, really?
Bradley Cooper and other things.
Yeah. I think what I would say is, pertaining only to myself, I'm not a reality casting director. I cast actors that are capable of doing the roles. You know, very few actors get the opportunity to play what they are capable of playing. And like I said, most play a version of themselves in different situations. But to erase the fact that you couldn't have someone play what they're capable of playing, I think is insane. I think it is a bit of, political correctness that we're in these days. And I think, you know, what you're doing is, not everybody is a star. Not everybody is an artist. And I know generations of kids are growing up thinking, oh, I want to be a TikTok star. I want to be a this star. I want to be a influencer. Not everybody's built out for that. Not everybody can be an actor. It's an incredibly special profession that requires training and soul. I mean, just if you think about what actors put themselves on the line for every day, going into a room of strangers and exposing your soul, exposing your flaws, exposing your emotions. Not many people do that on a day-to-day basis. So the fact is that, you know, you're going to take people that are capable of that and only relegate them to play straight characters because they're straight in real life, or gay characters because they're gay in real life, or trans or Jewish or, you know, some ethnic quality. It seems to me to be at odds with what the craft of acting is. The craft of acting is make-believe and, stretching one person's persona into a myriad of others and telling a story. So I think it's short-sighted and very limiting when people address that. I mean, so I think it's difficult, but for me, the answer is not to just cast people because they're that in real life.
Is there a debate around Superman? I didn't even know this.
No, not really. Although I did see articles after we cast David Cornsweet that he has, I believe his grandfather might have been Jewish or something. And so there were some two or three articles about the fact of going into the conspiracy of who wrote and created Superman, mm-hmm. And the use of, you know, kind of Israeli sounding names with, you know, the father and the parents and all that kind of stuff, some connection to, you know, being Jewish in that project.
You've been very humble through this interview and saying that you're all casting someone, you know, it's a process, but I'm going to ask you to not be in here because I really want to know what's a couple of examples or one that you're most proud of that you really feel, wow, I made this happen.
I think Heath would probably be one of them. The problem is I unbeknownst to you, Christina, I forget most of the films that I've ever done. So there's that process. When there's 250 projects almost, I'm like, okay, forget that one. But I think, you know, that's certainly, you know, Yellowstone, I'm incredibly proud of. I really love The Offer. So I think, you know, I think different shows for different reasons. And I have to say, I think the reality is, for me, it's giving actors opportunities and putting them in positions where they can excel. But also what I remember about projects is not, you know, it's very kind for people to say, an agent called me a couple months ago, and this is on Superman, somebody that got a role. And he called and said, well, you've just changed another actor's life, and I appreciate it. And that's kind of an overwhelming statement to hear. And I don't, you know, like, that's sweet of you to say, but she delivered in the moments, not me. Number one, I just saw it in her. And number two, I think the real thing that that sticks with me is the opportunity to work with the people, the creative people that I get to again and again and again. You know, that's where the real reward is, you know, for me, because that's what I'll remember, those friendships, those personalities, being part of a creative team that put really special projects together, stays with you a lot longer than the money you get, you know, paid, or, you know, credits that accumulate over time. It's about those friendships. And I value the fact that I have worked with directors and producers over and over and over again. And that's humbling to me, you know, that people trust me and trust my taste and tolerate my personality.
So what are you working on?
Let's see. Well, I'm not working on one damn thing right now because of the strike.
Strikes, of course.
But I was in the middle of Superman with James Gunn. We are in the middle of a project with Taylor Sheridan called Landman, which is a Billy Bob Thornton show that we're putting together. We're in the middle of that. Let's see, what the heck else? Oh, Karate Kid, we've been working on the new Karate Kid movie. So, you know, it varies. And then there's all the things that I need to go back to. Mm-hmm. I will go back to The Night Agent once we can, a show that I did for Netflix. We'll go back to Yellowstone. We'll go back to things that are that we need to. We go back to Lioness for Taylor, the special ops Lioness. So there's a lot of things that I'm waiting on coming together, continuing work on that I'm excited about that have all been, you know, hit the pause button for the time being.
Let's hope these strikes get resolved as soon as possible. That when that cork explodes, there's going to be so much where you guys are going to be swamped. Yeah. I can't even imagine how you start.
And, you know, and that's the problem. I mean, you know, everybody will be released from the starting gate at the same time. So you'll be competing not only for the same actors, but the same studios, the same crews that you that have to, it'll be incredibly busy. But that's, you know, it's much better than the alternative. I worry about my staff. I work with at the moment six or seven incredibly talented people, and I'd love to continue working with them, but it all depends on what happens. You know, the fallout of these strikes, or, you know, or you can't stress enough how many people are affected. You know, I also own a restaurant. You brought up my art gallery. Mm-hmm. Also own a restaurant. You know, all of those industries are affected by the strike in Hollywood. Not just actors, not just casting directors or writers, but waiters and delivery people and grocery stores. And, you know, there's a huge fallout to this work stoppage that I hope calmer minds prevail and they can find a way through.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to leave you by saying that I cannot wait for there to be a casting Oscar. I can't believe that there isn't one. I've spoken to a few casting directors throughout my history with my show here. And I just can't, I keep thinking every year it's going to happen, but I know you've won a lot of casting awards in general, but I mean, this is something that I really hope is going to happen sooner.
I do too. I think it's a real shame. It's a real crime, you know, that the casting is not represented by the Academy. I'm a member of the Academy. I've certainly voted for there to be more recognition and have tried to be vocal about it. But, you know, it's an essential part. You know, I mean, when I get feisty and why I say people tolerate my personality, I will say things. And, you know, when people tell me, oh, director's too busy on a location scout, or he's in a wardrobe and makeup thing and you can't get to him, or this is a priority. None of those exist without casting, period. You don't have an actor, you're not going to be putting that hat on a location set. So, you know, it starts and ends with performance and these people telling a story and being part of it. And how that's not recognized as a vital, crucial part of any creative process is insane. And it should be corrected. Yeah, it should be corrected.
And also, I think that it's just in terms of the audience. I think casting is something that even laymen really understand. You can really see this was a great portrait of this person or this was not. I didn't like how she did.
And the reason people go
to
movies. I mean, yes, sure, there are the stories like Oppenheimer that, you know, smart people like you have read, you know, American Prometheus or had the book around and are aware of. Most people are not, you know, and so they decide on whether they go to a movie because of the actors in it or the director, you know, and in some cases, certainly in Chris's case. But it's such an integral part of everything that shades all of it. I don't care if they're the best special effects in the world. If actors don't convey the truth of those moments, it's wasted. It's useless. And so the fact that the Academy has not voted for a casting director award is really an injustice to the, you know, myriad of casting directors that have put blood, sweat, and tears into their work. And yet will not be recognized, you know, sadly due to, you know, a lot of directors' egos and a lot of producers' egos. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a shame. And I hope it does change.
Oh, I hope so too. I can't wait to see all your other upcoming projects. And thank you so much for your time and for the amazing work with Oppenheimer, really.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Thank you so much to John Papsidera. Oppenheimer is, of course, in theaters now. And thank you so much for listening to Pop Culture Confidential. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can find us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review the show. It really helps us out. Thank you so much.
Hello. Welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book. And together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our 9th season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.